Chapter 18. The morning exploded into a frenzy after the distress horn from the soaring light announced the dawn. I could almost feel the whole place wake up at once due to the jarring sound, like the floating skyship was connected with her sister vessel out at sea. Horace and I completed our crash course session right before the Mantis ship came alive with sounds and activity, which was lucky because soon I would have to start getting into character. I shuddered just thinking about the bastard I had to imitate. And if there weren't so much on the line, I would say fuck it and just slit the pirate captain's throat on sight. But patience was a virtue, and when it came to not one, but two very real enemies with a whole brigade at their backs and the ability to see an attack coming from miles away, I had to play my cards right. Horace was great because he recognized my need for isolation from the crew until I could really settle into the role I'd signed myself up for. So when Vela knocked hesitantly on the library doors in search of Jenner because he always took a cup of his pungent tea at this hour, the Falcon Man sent her away with some excuses that he promised to explain later. "What else do I need to prepare, Chief?" he asked me once we were alone again with the comatose Koala Man for company. "We need to get that stuff out of storage and set up," I began to list. "Maybe this could keep Vel occupied if you wouldn't mind informing her. And if you talk with Zoe, I'm sure you both can team up to keep the rest of the crew functioning as normal until the last second." "Why the last second?" he asked. "Don't you want them to get used to your new demeanor a bit?" "No, because the less time everyone can sit with their thoughts about what's going on with me, the less the rogue will be able to figure out the details of their shock when we are all face to face," I explained. "I don't really know much about this auger, but they sound powerful, and if Amaya was able to visit me in a dream from out at sea, then there is no telling what this guy can do." "True," Horace said. And then he tore a random scrap of paper off a sheet of paper I hoped wasn't important to Jenner at all. "Some of the rogue augurs have been known in the past to fully exert their will upon others from hundreds of leagues away." "That's terrifying," I remarked as I watched him grab a quill and actually jot some notes down in a responsible manner. "Okay, so talk to Zoe for more details and set Miss Velly on the path to decoration. Got it?" Horace said, and tossed away the quill. "Make sure you study some of the obvious social cues, like the proper greeting I give you as your manservant, and your answer to my servitude, things like that. Those are the basics that would be a dead giveaway as to how foreign you really are. If the Alders have been here for as long as you say, they are naturalized Aventolians by now, and are sure to act like them, especially if they are used to living like, or among, duelists." "I agree, but I have a confession," I said, as I felt the stakes rise even higher against me and what I wanted to accomplish. "A big part of me is still worried I might drop the ball on trying to act this cruel to my own people. Because of that, you and I have to be ready to break character at a moment's notice and fight, because I have a bad feeling about how everything is going to go down. If they didn't have that damned rogue, this would be quite a different battle strategy," Horace said with a deep frown on his face. "I hate this cloak and dagger shit," I sighed, and pinched the bridge of my nose. "I just want to crack open their skulls and be done with it." "I have similar sentiments, Chief," Horace said, as he clapped me on the shoulder. "I'll make sure there is breakfast and a hot coley drink for you." "Thanks, H," I said. And the Falcon Man left me alone in the library so he could prepare and look out for the Mantis ship like the trusty second he was. I remained in the library and walked over to sit on the floor between two library stacks where the view through the window was the best. I didn't know if the plan would work, but I was hoping that if I could get myself to doze off again, I might be able to make contact with Amaya in her liminal space like before. So, just like a barn cat, I curled up on my side in a shaft of sunlight and let my overtired mind do the rest. A lot of what I thought about swirled aimlessly through my synapses like snow melting down the face of a mountain, and I didn't try to control it or worry about the fact I was thinking too hard. I just breathed and let my thoughts take their course. Soon the landscape faded from my view and was replaced by that idyllic meadow from before. I sat up and looked around, but instead of finding the Oryx woman, I discovered I was in the meadow alone. "Amaya," I called out, and I watched the clouds billow in and out like they were actually breathing. "Are you there?" When I heard nothing but the howling of the wind, I wondered how it was that I'd actually managed to get here by myself. But before I could wonder any longer, the sound of the wind changed into something more familiar.
"Alex, are you here?"
Amaya's faint voice echoed around the meadow. "Ames, where are you?" I asked, and kept my head on a swivel, even though it was clear she wasn't anywhere close to being able to physically manifest.
"I'm using all of my energy just to make contact with you,"
she said weakly. "Are you hurt?" I demanded, and tried to pull back the reins on my galloping thoughts. If she said yes, all bets were off, and rogue or not, I was going to come in guns blazing on the back of my pterodactyl like a goddamn thunderstorm.
"No, not hurt,"
she relayed, or at least her disembodied voice did, and I relaxed.
"But the rogue Olga decided he couldn't trust me and put a collar around my neck that keeps me awake. He somehow knew I was trying to do something while asleep, and even though I threw him off the scent, he's quite a suspicious one."
Part of me wanted to huff out a laugh because she sounded more annoyed and put out than afraid, like a typical hostage probably should have been. But the thought of anyone putting a collar on her had me grinding my teeth. Riding Law into battle was still very much an option, but I knew if I played the long con, there was a better chance of getting everyone out alive and as unharmed as I could. So despite the fact we were in this hairy pit of a mess, there was a silver lining. The time of our reunion was drawing near, and I would finally get to hold her in my arms again. I just had to slog my way through a pile of shit to get to her, but I would take that any day over any harm coming to her. "It's good to hear your voice, even if I can't see you," I breathed out. "We just heard the horn, and Horace is probably going to get Bowden to steer the airship toward the harbor. I have a plan, so don't worry."
"It's not me that I'm worried about,"
she confessed, and her voice faded out like turning the dial of a stereo down. "Ames?" I asked, and waited for a beat. "Amaya!"
"Sorry. It's hard,"
she said, and her voice sounded even more distant.
"I'm preoccupied with Anna."
"What's wrong with her?" I questioned, as the wind started to pick up some more.
"The rogue enchanted her mind somehow, but I don't know what it was that he did,"
she explained, and my heart broke just a little at the sound of the sobs in her voice.
"She doesn't even recognize me, and she keeps saying she's not my mage. He's made her forget about me."
"Shh, my love," I soothed, and my fingers ached with the need to grasp her and hold her tight, but she was out of my reach. "We will work it all out, I promise."
"Hurry, Alex,"
she sobbed again, and then I could feel conscious reality pull me back into the present where only a few minutes had gone by based on the shadows slanting across the floor. I sat upright and squeezed the muscles at the joint of my neck and shoulders so I could absently rub out the tension. The rumble of the airship could be felt through the floor, and the knowledge that Horace must have talked to whoever was in the wheelhouse was what forced me back to my feet. We were heading for the harbor where the distress call had been sent out, and when we arrived, there was no going back. Nothing was going to change by sitting here. So I forced myself to go over some of the things Horace wanted me to, like greetings and such. There was the whole Lord Master crap I would have to get used to pretty darn quickly, as well as issuing a lot of orders on my part, and I had to wrap my head around having my wives basically attend to my every whim. I wasn't going to go as far as some of the duelists it described in the How-To book. From what I was reading, some duelists even assigned specific wives to singular tasks, such as putting on their shoes or dressing them. It was a wonder the big bad elitist fucks were even potty trained. Barring basic shit like that, I needed to make sure I never did anything myself, like getting my own drink or stoking the fire. Anything deemed worthy of a servant needed to be outsourced to Vela or my wives. I apparently also needed to prepare a gift when inviting another duelist to stay at my estate. This was still considered the formal custom and matched the period of the role I was attempting to hearken back to. If the pirate captain was worth his salt, he would know how to act if he was truly impersonating the overseer. If the captain had arrived with a gift himself in recognition of the old custom, then I would know he was just as prepared as I was. Interestingly enough, the old custom even dictated that if either party were to reject the gift, then it was open grounds for a duel regardless of status. Over time, this became a way for ashers to try and trick each other into dueling by presenting either their guests or their hosts with terrible gifts that had no value or were just plain grotesque in nature. Because the custom was also binding indefinitely, if the asher later tried to get rid of or destroy the gift at any point after the fact, they were open game. This led to some complications when it came to sorting out the validity of some duels, so the custom changed to have some limitations placed on them. For instance, this used to be a lifetime binding contract, but it was then reduced to just a year or season, according to Aventolian timekeeping. It was wacky, but when in Ohm, I didn't know what would be appropriate, and I really didn't want to devote a whole lot of thought to it. Something would come to me, I was certain of it. So I stashed that on the back burner for now and scanned the notes Jenner had left behind when it came to Krev. From what I could tell, the man was quite paranoid and wrote in a code that looked like the old Microsoft font wingdings circa 1997. However, good old Jenner was able to crack it with a basic cipher, and what he did manage to translate made me cringe. Some of the snippets were things that started to describe what Krev would do to Nova in his free time, and I was thankful when the koala man obviously stopped because I didn't really need to know the details. The little I did know made me feel as if I would come unglued if I thought about it for too long, and now was not the time to get distracted by my temper. But fuck, this was going to be difficult. I continued to search the notes for anything else when a familiar document caught my attention. It was an official-looking paper with a stamp I'd only seen once before back on Nada because I was sent an almost identical one after I'd acquired Velralla from the traders at the auction ball. It was the same odd wording in the preface of the contract, but the stamp across this one said, "Sold at auction in lieu of Lot 23. And then, instead of summarizing the cockatoo woman, it listed details of... "Holy shit, this is the Airy," I said out loud, as I continued to skim through the info printed on the piece of parchment, and I had to rack my brain to remember the connection. The auction ball. After Velralla's late husband died, she was sent back to the traders, as was custom for assets who didn't have an owner. At the auction, I'd attempted to purchase her back after she begged us to take her in. But another bidder, the masked asher, kept upping the ante. He'd seemed inordinately fixed on acquiring the cockatoo woman for himself, and at the time I figured it was simply because she was his type or something. After all, she knew how to be a duelist's wife, as well as turn a mean profit in the market. So much so that she'd actually earned somewhat of a name for herself in Nada's social circles, so I just thought the masked asher found her valuable due to the reputation she'd made for herself. Whatever the case, at the time I recognized he was intent on her, unless I did something like replace her with something even more worth his while. That something happened to be the property I inherited when I dueled Arcus Dohler. But at the time, the jury was still out on whether or not the duel was legit. The traders, however, did not operate the way the council did, so it was a race of bureaucracy in which the traders pushed their papers fastest, and I was allowed to put that property up in place of Vel. And it worked because having assets and property as a duelist meant nothing if you didn't have estates to keep them all. The Airy itself was a testament to what could happen if you only had one estate and a hoarding problem. Ugh. Trash spiders. Forever scarred. I didn't really think much about the swap at the time, especially since I was relieved I didn't have to deal with said trash spiders. But now it was a known fact. The masked bidder at the ball was actually Krev Alda. The niggle in my brain niggled harder, and I ran over to the shelf of record stones in order to find one that might help me. My eyes skimmed rapidly over the labels, and I had to double back as I accidentally skipped over the one I wanted. Tovish 1, the label read, and my hand hovered over the glass bead a moment before I made up my mind and grabbed the one next to it labeled Tovish 2 instead. That fateful day when we all had to escape the enchanted junk hoard booby trap in the Aerie was also the day old Tobias Tovish sacrificed himself so the rest of us could make it out alive. But before he could shuffle off this mortal coil, he'd left Jenner his own personal archives he'd collected. Some were from Aang in the time before the uprisings, and whatever he'd managed to save afterwards, and I figured this had to be what was mostly on Tovish 1. However, the info I was curious about was what Tovish smuggled from Gela Vane in his time working for the bastard as his personal archivist. I figured if there was indeed a connection between Krev Alda and Vel'Rala, I might know more if I knew why Vane wanted to duel Krev in the first place, especially right after he acquired the Aerie publicly at auction. From what I knew, Kavo originally wanted his brother Krev to be a spy at the auction ball for whatever nefarious purposes those were. Instead, he entered the ball as an Asher and actually participated in the auctions, which only an Asher with a legitimate duelist stone could do. When the transaction was complete, he was the one who ran out of there so fast he didn't even claim his lot, and it made me wonder whether or not there might have been another spy there too. Like the corrupt magistrate of Gatetown, Gela Vane, the man who later came after him. Later I found out the Aldas mostly dabbled in the mercenary business, or at least Kavo did. And that meant becoming a duelist, the sworn enemy of the mercenary clans, was strictly forbidden. Yet Krev did so anyway, and he ended up faking his death, potentially several times over, by doing something to absorb other people's essence like he was some sort of vampire. No matter how he did it, the fact remained that Krev dabbling in duelist life was a big no-no, and it would make some good blackmail material if used right. Given those circumstances and the fact Gela Vane dueled Krev, it didn't take a genius to guess who the blackmailer might have been. The only question was why did Vane have it out for Krev enough to go through dueling him with nothing to show for it? He was never able to claim the Aerie because Krev never claimed it after the auction ball. And now that property was in a perpetual state of no man's land. What was left of it after we'd accidentally set it on fire, that is. With this thought in mind, I clutched the record stone in my hand and focused on what I wanted answers for. The process, when Jenner explained it to me one time, was similar to using Google to search for keywords or phrases the archivist would have used as footholds in order to perfectly remember every square inch of the page with their eidetic memories. In this instance, I just had to think about Gela Vane, and whatever relevant information would appear in my mind's eye as well as on the surface of the clear stone, like a memory. The strange thing about pulling something specific from a record stone was the feeling that the memories weren't my own, but Tovish's. As I scoured through the archives, I saw how he dutifully recorded what he could from the mad ravings of Vane, as well as his personal library. A bunch of hits came up, of course, but when I cross-referenced Gela Vane's search with Krev Alda, only a few items worthy of perusal jumped out. Much easier to sift through. I grabbed some of the papers I was looking through and took a seat in the armchair across from the slumbering Jenner so I could read. The first thing that came up on the surface of the record stone was the page I was reading just prior, the auction receipt. I glanced between the document projected on the surface of the stone and the physical one in my hand. They were identical all the way down to the secondary stamp at the bottom that read unclaimed in large red splattered letters. The only difference was the one Tovish got from Vane's archives had the word copy on it. So, this was proof Vane was either at the auction, or at least knew about it. Check. The shadows moved swiftly by the windows, and the changing light reminded me we were actively heading to the harbor at full speed ahead. So I should really be using my time to prepare for my role. But I just knew I was close to something. I gripped the record stone again and specifically thought about how Vane must have wanted Krev dead. Maybe there was a plan or something. Odd encrypted writing swirled to the surface, and I recognized both the strange symbols that reminded me of Wingdings and the cipher key Jenner was using to translate Krev Yate's version of Lolita, among other things. The image on the glass surface of the stone had the same Wingding writing, but it was composed in an orderly and formal letter format clearly addressed to Gellivane. When I scrolled through this image, I could see Tovish had deciphered the letter just like Jenner did. Honestly, I must have read the thing 4 times. Because it was entertaining as hell, first of all, and two, because in between all of the angry tangents and clever name-calling, I was able to piece together the narrative of just what had happened between Vane and Krev. Basically, what this letter boiled down to was a non-sequential account of events starting decades back when Krev and his brother had first arrived on Aventol as travelers. They all started as allies, but soon, Kavo and Gela came up with a side plot that ended up being against Krev. Something about a woman coming between the brothers and then coming between Kavo and Gela. Obviously, the three of them had a Yoko Ono moment, and their grand plans on gaining control over all of Aventol as a supremely evil trifecta were disbanded. Instead, it seemed as if the three of them had been playing a game of kings on the socio-political chessboard for quite a while. Krev admitted to turning the tables on Gela in some unforgivable offense about a canterfly that I skipped because it was a lot more boring than it sounded, just so he could drive a wedge between Gela and Kavo. He then got back in his brother's good graces, but since Gela ratted on him about the auction and thereby told Kavo of his cardinal duelist sins, Krev had been officially banished from Clan Thorn. In conclusion, Krev confessed to being weary of the game they were playing as well as life. And he gave Gela an open invitation to duel him so he could go out at least honorably at the hand of a former friend. Of course, this ended up being another ruse because Krev had faked his death, etc. But at the time, Gela didn't know that, so to sweeten the deal, Krev told him about how he would be able to take over the Eyrie. Apparently, this was before Gellivane retrieved the copy of the public record of the property's unclaimed status, because it was enough to entice him into engaging in what he thought was a duel. So even though he walked away with an improved duelist rank, he couldn't get his hands on the Eyrie and whatever was so valuable there. Because from what I could see, there were small allusions here and there about something referred to as the machine. That, I could tell, was going to be a whole other thing. So I dog-eared whatever the fresh hell the machine spelled, and my brain snagged over the final salient detail, which was that this wasn't one letter, but two. And the second was obviously sent after the fact as a big old fuck you, I got away with faking my death. And also, Krev apparently said he had intentions on going back and claiming the property after he lured me out with his secret weapon and killed me. The last part of the letter stood out among all the rest, especially given the secret weapon had to have been Nova. And she did, in fact, lure us here by Krev's manipulations. I would have to come back to that one and have a talk with Nova. But the rest of the paragraph was what snagged my attention the hardest. The last laugh is on you, Gela. Not only will I have the machine, but I will soon have the true divine as well once I inherit the bitch from Brightwood's estates. That is, unless you get to him first. Let the games continue, you self-righteous bastard. At the time, however, Gela was interested in Shay, not Velralla. But maybe he didn't know whatever Krev did. There was still more I needed to figure out, but at least I felt like I was getting closer and closer to my theory being right. Gela thought Shay was what Krev had called the true divine, which I didn't blame him for. Her incarnate powers were the definition of divine. But Krev's research had pointed him in the direction of the prophetess, and not of Nada's keeper, like Vane's did. It was just more proof each individual bastard had basically caused his own undoing by being too big for their britches and trying to fuck with what was mine. As the Manta ship slowed down, I smelled the sweet ocean air through the high windows of the library, and I had a boost in confidence instead of anxiousness as we approached our destination. Because both Gela and Krev and all those who came before them had all failed to factor me into their equations. And just like all who came before, all who would come after would rue the day they fucked with me and mine. They wouldn't even see me coming. A knock sounded outside the closed doors, and Vela's hesitant voice floated through the wood.
There's a situation at the harbor, Mr. Alex.
Showtime.